This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Ernst Rutz, gee, it's been a long time. Years.
Yeah, Jeremy, good to see you again. And good to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
I tried to catch up with you when I was in Pretoria a few days ago, and you only replied to me 4 days later.
It was not as a result of professional reasons. It was merely personal. That's all. So rest assured. It's not that I don't want to be on your podcast. It's just that I don't want to be your friend.
It was more exciting to have fish and chips and a beer.
Yeah. So no, it's good to be here. Congratulations, you became a father. How's that?
Yes,
it's going well. It's a great experience.
It is phenomenal. We're still trying to find out who the father is, but other than that, it's going really great.
Well, I'm happy to hear that.
When you were last on my show, it was right at the beginning of COVID. A lot has happened. You've changed position. I mean, you were at AfriForum and now you're at Solidarity. Is that right?
Yes. I'm at the Solidarity movement, which is slightly different. I'm in the Solidarity building. But so the difference between Solidarity and the Solidarity movement is Solidarity is the union as it was used, as it was known back then. It's more a workers' organization aimed at, you know, fighting racial discrimination in the workplace, all stuff related to do with work, workers' rights and so forth. And then the Solidarity movement is actually the group of institutions together, like the network is called the Solidarity movement. So that includes AfriForum, Solidarity, the Helping Hand, the Federation of Afrikaans Cultural Organizations, Academia, all of those. And then the Solidarity Movement has an office. That's where I'm working now. And the Solidarity Movement office is very small. We believe in federalism. So you might call it the central office, but it's not really a head office or something like that. It's a small office that sort of coordinates between the different institutions within the Solidarity Movement. And my role there is head of policy. So I'm more in charge of, you know, writing policy documents and working sort of more on the content side. But yeah, it's been exciting.
So the Solidarity movement, in a way, is kind of more conceptual. It's more abstract as opposed to the hands-on nature of, say, AfriForum and Solidarity.
You might say that it's so the movement has grown in a way organically. It started with Solidarity is actually very old. It's one of the oldest institutions in South Africa. It used to be the mine workers union that was founded just after the Anglo-Boer War, when many of those farmers went into the mines to become miners. Eventually after the political change in 1994, with the new dispensation, many of those old Afrikaner institutions collapsed, or almost all of them. The mine workers union was on the verge of collapse when it was completely transformed. And I think it would have collapsed as well if they didn't transform it. So it was transformed in the sense that the constitution was rewritten, the whole strategy was rewritten, and the name was changed as well. The name was changed to Solidarity. Solidarity then reactivated the Solidarity Helping Hand, which was also an old institution, created AfriForum and so forth. And so the movement office is sort of the I don't want to say the middle point, but it's sort of a coordinating role between these institutions. It's not that much an executionary office. So the movement itself doesn't have campaigns and things like AfriForum, like you said, but it does play a coordinative role between the institutions.
I find that more interesting anyway, because what Solidarity in the meta is about preserving and conserving effectively Afrikaner culture and tradition and customs and so on. Isn't that right?
Yes. It's about, so the tagline is, we want a safe, free and prosperous future in the southern tip of Africa. So we have all these different institutions working in different ways to help to achieve that.
Okay. So when you and I last spoke on my show, I had a very small international audience. Now my international audience has grown substantially. So for those who don't know what you're talking about, what are you talking about?
the short version of the context is, if you know, 94 or the early 90s, there was this dream about the new South Africa, the miracle, and it was just Francois Pienaar and 95 Rugby World Cup, and Oprah was talking about the miracle in South Africa, and Charlize Theron, and you know, everything. It was just wonderful. And a lot of people had high hopes for the future of this country. And fast forward to where we are now, and almost every aspect of South African society is collapsing. And now, in a certain sense, we could say that South Africa is actually the first post-Western society on Earth. There were many other countries that were sort of decolonized, you know, African countries and so forth. But the extent to which South Africa was firstly developed into what you could describe as a Western country, and then secondly, the extent to which Western institutions, such as liberal democratic institutions, democracy and parliaments and things like that, have been created and strengthened to a significant extent and then taken over and used to combat or fight the very thing that they claim to want to pursue or protect. Like, the aim of a parliament is to promote democracy, and in our case, it's the aim is to promote the liberal democratic view. That's what the constitution says, but now the constitution is used to promote socialism and things like that. So within this context, the Afrikaner community used to be very well organized, used to be very well, I think still is very good at administration, at arranging things and setting up organizations and building institutions and so forth. And so what we're doing now is to, that's not how we describe it, but a lot of people describe it as a state within a state or a parallel government, a parallel state. In other words, we're just doing our own thing. We're not dependent. We're not waiting for the government to do things that will make our lives better. We're just saying, well, we're going to do it ourselves. So if we're concerned about crime, we start our own neighborhood watches. If we're concerned about education, we build our own schools. We build our own tertiary institutions. If we're concerned about our culture not being protected or heritage site not being sites not being preserved, we strengthen the Federation of Afrikaans Cultural Organizations. And in that way, what we're effectively doing is creating a, you could say, a de facto government or a de facto state. In other words, that even though there's nothing written in the constitution about anything to this effect, that's just the reality that we have created. And there's something quite exciting about this. And I also think for your international audience, I think there's a lot that the rest of the world and the Western world in particular, America and Western Europe and so forth, can learn from what is happening in South Africa at the moment.
Yeah, interestingly enough, what you're talking about actually has happened in other variations throughout history. I mean, South Tyrol, which is in what, Northern Italy, is a great example of something very similar. The Hanseatic League is also in many ways overlapping with what you're talking about.
Yes. So there are different forms of self-determination. And people tend to think of self-determination and they think secession. Now, secession is always the best possible outcome if you're a nation and you want to govern yourself. In other words, you break away from the state and you literally form your own government in all the official terms of the word. You become a member of the United Nations and all of that. But secession is sort of a romantic thing to talk about, but it's not quite that easy. It's not as easy as people think. It's not just holding a referendum and then you're your own country. But through secession, you violate the self-determination of a particular country. So there's self-determination in terms of a nation wanting to govern itself, but there's also self-determination in terms of the actual state that you are in has a degree of self-determination. So it becomes a bit tricky. But there are other forms of self-determination as well. So you have territorial autonomy, as it's called, and South Tyrol is a very good example of this. Perhaps Orania is sort of a proto-version of that. In other words, it's just a territory that people start creating again, just taking control over a particular territory or assuming control and then starting to act as if they are the government. And in South Tyrol, or in many cases, they have received a degree of recognition for what they are doing. And so South Tyrol in Italy is now an autonomous province. The other sort of broad category is called cultural autonomy. And that is when a particular cultural community is sort of spread out over a large territory, like the Afrikaners is a good example of that. Other than maybe Orania, there are very few places in South Africa where Afrikaners are a majority. And so the cultural approach to self-determination is to have some form of a system that says we recognize that there is a minority, this particular minority community or minority communities that comply with a particular list of criteria. And they will have a degree of autonomy over their own things. So, for example, one way to do this is for such a community to have the authority to form its own parliament, to make its own laws on issues that affect their community. They can't make laws over other communities, but you can make laws, for example, about what your children will be taught in school. And you can use an amount of your a percentage of the tax money that you pay to go into such projects. So there are examples like that as well. So I think it's quite exciting. I think the world is changing, and it seems increasingly that the world is changing more rapidly. And so politically also, it seems in South Africa, this void has been created or is being created, this political vacuum, as Arends van Sail or Conscious Caracal has remarked, it's either going to be filled by the good guys or the bad guys. So it's up to us to make sure that this void is filled by the good guys.
The Amish are another great example of sort of self-determination.
Yeah, you could say that in a way. I don't know that much about the Amish, but they do have their own community where they live and where they practice their own cultures, their own traditions, their own way of doing things. They have their own rules. They operate on a different, you might call it a different legal system than the United States Constitution. I don't know if they're really in breach of the Constitution, but they have different rules. It's de facto. In other words, just in real life, it's different. It's completely different to the rest of America. And they are getting recognition for that, or they are recognized for doing this, again, because not because they asked the government whether they can do this, but just because they have started doing it a very long time ago, and they keep doing this. And it's a reality that the government can either recognize or ignore or try to squash. And I think they've opted to just recognize it. That's often the road of least resistance.
Wouldn't the road of least resistance simply be, I don't know, leave, go somewhere else, emigrate, if this is not conducive to happy environment?
Yeah, I think that is a more difficult question to answer from an Afrikaner perspective. It seems to me that over the last year or so, immigration has sort of picked up again. Maybe it's just my personal frame of reference with people I know who are leaving the country. But the Afrikaner community, more than I would say the Anglo community or the white English-speaking community in South Africa, are very much culturally attached to South Africa. And there is this thing of disintegrating, or if we all just leave and go to England or New Zealand or wherever, our culture will die out. I have a lot of English friends in South Africa who have said that they don't think there is really such a thing as English South African culture. Or if there is such a thing, it's not very deep. But it's much easier culturally or psychologically speaking for an English speaking person in South Africa to pack up and go to another country than I think for an Afrikaans speaking person.
Why is that?
There are practical reasons like language barriers and so forth, but also one reason is Afrikaners especially tend to be more religious, more Christian. And I've noticed, and not only have I noticed this personally, but we've seen some research that confirms this, that a lot of Afrikaners get a sort of a culture shock when they move to other countries. Like going to Australia sounds great. I'm going to Australia to get a job. But then people realize that how atheistic Australia really is. And then you realize that your children are being ridiculed at school for being Christians, or you don't have a church that you can go to, or you can't find a place to send your kids to. That's a very practical thing. But the other thing is just this attachment to the soil, to the African continent, and the idea that Africa is my home. And even if I go to another country, especially the Netherlands, you know, there's this thing, go back to the Netherlands. But I mean, I've been to the Netherlands a few times, and it's a beautiful country and good people. Some strange people also, but also some good people. But by no means did I go there and felt like I was home. I felt like I was visiting another country. It goes back to history also. I know the if we compare the Afrikaners and the English in South Africa, the English also have a very deep history in South Africa, and like the Anglo-Zulu Wars that I think a lot of people don't know about and so forth. But I think there's something about the whole thing of the Great Trek and the Boer Republics and the history of whether it's Piet Retief or Paul Kruger, and all these generations that have fought to create a future here. And so packing up and leave is, in a way, turning your back on that. And I think a lot of people who do leave, we find that maybe they leave for economic reasons or they leave because of crime or whatever. But most of them, I would say, have this sort of hope that maybe one day if things get better, they can come back.
Yeah, I mean, what you're kind of alluding to is most things, almost everything is downstream from culture.
That's absolutely the case. And I know you've been talking about this for some time, but a lot of people, it's really bizarre how people either cannot comprehend this or they do not want to comprehend this, just how important culture is. And everything is downstream from culture. And when I say culture, I mean in its most simple sense of the word is just the way that a people or a community do things. And there's this big debate about whether you can say some cultures are better than others, but I think you can respect all cultures, some more than others, depending on what the culture is, of course. But the fact of the matter is that cultures are different. And that implies that the way in which people live, the way in which people think is different. And this modern idea of diversity is to pretend that this doesn't exist, or to actively work to destroy this under the banner of diversity, which is bizarre. It's like waging war on nature, or waging war on reality. It's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying for a while now that egalitarianism is a huge con. I mean, I love my wife, but that doesn't mean I hate other women. You love your wife, it doesn't mean you hate other women. You just prefer the woman who's closest to you and who's in your life.
I like to go back to the story of G.K. Chesterton. I think, I actually can't remember where he wrote this. It might have been in Orthodoxy, I think. But anyways, he tells this story about he's sitting in a London tea shop, and across from him in the tea shop is a Chinese guy, a British Chinese person. And so he says, all this talk about modernity and inclusivity and all these new ideas and human rights still doesn't change the fact that he, as G.K. Chesterton, has more in common with the ancient Greek historian Herodotus than he has with this Chinese person. And then he goes on to say that he thinks he knows to an extent how someone like, he mentions some names, I think he mentions Isaiah in the Bible and Pericles, he mentions these ancient figures. He thinks when he reads their history, he thinks he understands how they thought, because he sort of shares a culture, at least in the broad sense of the word, with them. But he cannot really comprehend how someone like Li Hongzhang or some ancient Chinese emperor thought or felt, because it's just a different culture. And then he says that he thinks it's the same way with that person sitting, although he doesn't know him, will probably have a much better idea how someone like Li Hongzhang thought, but wouldn't comprehend how someone like Isaiah in the Bible or Pericles or whoever thought in the way that he did. And this is not to dislike that person or to wish to have to discriminate against that person. It's just a recognition of cultural dynamics. It's really strange and sad that in many ways you could say that modernity is the core of modernity is an attempt to destroy culture or to wage war on cultural realities. And I think if we recognize that, we're going to have much less trouble in the world.
Well, I'll take it a step further and say that it's a war against white culture, white Caucasian culture in the West, particularly. That's my position. That's what you're seeing happening. But it doesn't mean to say that now you must become some sort of supremacist. It simply means that you can preserve your own. I love that saying, diversity is our strength. It's complete nonsense. If you're on a tour bus with 30 people from different countries and different languages, and you're the only one from South Africa who speaks English, you can't understand anybody else. How is that a strength? Or if you've got 20 engineers working on a bridge, and all of them are from different fields of research, you know, diverse, one's a geologist or whatever, okay? That bridge is not going to be very strong. You need 20 engineers who are very good at building a bridge.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and the classical story of that is in the Bible, is the story of the Tower of Babel. In a sense, you could say the story of the Tower of Babel is a warning against diversity. Now, in some ways, I do think diversity is a strength, in the sense that every person has a different skill set, within a community, has different talents, a different personality, and so forth. And that's the old classical idea. But a community is stronger when every person in that community finds his or her place where they can contribute best. And so that's diversity in the good sense of the word. But this modern idea of diversity is really just an attempt to pretend that culture doesn't exist. It's bound to fail.
It's actually such a stupid saying, because you and I are diverse. Me and my wife are diverse. We think differently on different things.
Yeah.
The only way you can't have diversity basically is, I don't know, having two Tesla robots which have the same programming.
Yeah, that would be the extreme form of reducing diversity. But I think there's something else to be said about this. I'm not convinced that the people who say diversity is a strength actually believe that diversity is a strength. I think they say this because it's a tactical thing for them to say, you can almost say, in the current phase of the struggle. The same way we heard people saying back in the 60s and 70s that people should not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, the left at least, and now they're turning their back on that. Now they're saying, well, that was fine for back then, but now we're changing it. And it's the same line of reasoning with arguing for minority rights, for example, when black people or some ethnic minorities that aren't white are in the minority, then you want minority rights. But then when they become the majority, or when white people become the minority, then minority rights is not relevant anymore. So all of these things, it's like a two-prong approach. And I think it's the same with diversity. And I don't only think that. You can see that in South Africa. For example, comparing the rugby team to Bafana Bafana, to the soccer team. It would be universally regarded as racist if someone were to say, why is the soccer team 100% black? We need more diversity, so we need to have some quotas to include white people in the team. It's almost bizarre to think about arguing that way. So when the team is 100% black, it's celebrated. When the rugby team is what is it, 50-50, white or black, I don't know, then it's criticized for not being black enough and not being representative. So all of these things about representativity and inclusion and diversity, that's the current phase of the struggle. I think once they achieve this, they're going to move on to something else and step away from what they are saying now, the same way they have already stepped away from Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and all these civil rights activists of the previous century.
You swallowed a little bit heavily when I suggested that there's a war against white people, but look at the laws, the legislations against white South Africans. That's black and white evidence.
No, I don't disagree with that. I would just frame it differently. I think it's undoubtedly the case that there is this, you can call it envy or hatred or whatever you want against white people. That is certainly the case. But there's also an underlying thing of a war against Western civilization, trying to destroy the contributions made by the West. I just recently read Jeremy Carl's book, The Unprotected Class. It's a new book. It was just published. And I actually did an interview with him on my podcast. It hasn't been published yet. It will be published soon. And the book is about, I think the subtitle is How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. And it's almost like talking about farm murders and like me when I wrote my book about farm killings, is when you put all of that information together and you read it as one book, as one whole, you sort of rediscover how bad it actually is when you just go after example, one example after the other. And so the one thing he points out is a term that is used in America. We don't really use it in South Africa, but I thought it's very striking. The notion of what they call celebration parallax. So parallax means when you look at the same thing from different angles, it looks differently. That's more or less sort of my layman's definition of a parallax. And so what the celebration parallax is two people can say the exact same thing, but depending on who said it will determine whether it's celebrated or whether it's rejected. There are many examples. One example would be Joe Biden, for example, saying when he chooses his running mate back in the previous election, he's going to make sure that it's a woman of color. And that was then celebrated, of course. People cheered him for saying that. And then he chose Kamala Harris. And then people came out and say Kamala Harris was chosen because she's a woman of color. And then people are angry about that. They say, you cannot say that. That's racist. And the same with this, and maybe a more controversial example, is this great replacement theory. So you have people on the left saying, we need to get rid of white people. We need to make sure that we have fewer white people in this country. And then again, it's celebrated. And there are examples of that. Jimmy Fallon, I don't know if you saw that clip. In one of his shows, he sort of casually spoke about census statistics that was released. And he said, well, the new census data is out. And I think he said something along the lines of, according to these new data, white people are now less than 50% of the population. And then people started cheering and clapping and applauding. And they were so happy that white people are now a minority. But if you are on the right and you say these people want to reduce the amount of white people, then you get attacked and you get called a conspiracy theorist. And so that's, I mean, there are so many examples in South Africa, again, of this same thing, that you can say the exact same thing, like literally word for word. But if you're on the left, you get celebrated for saying that. And if you're on the right, you get attacked for saying it.
You know, I am all about fighting the same fight as you. I'm not Afrikaans, but I mean, you know, I've known each other for years and I've got Afrikaner blood through, you know, half of my family line and who I'm married to, etc. So,
do you support the Blobela?
No.
Okay, so that's why you're not entirely Afrikaner. So.
But I appreciate the cause, the way in which the solidarity movement and the ethos is about preservation of Afrikaner tradition and culture. But a word that hasn't come up in our conversation is Boer. Mm. What is the difference, Arends, between an Afrikaner and a Boer?
Well, the short version, I can tell you, is it's the same thing. But there would be people who would vehemently disagree with that. And it's actually a very interesting discussion, this issue about what's the difference between an Afrikaner and a Boer, because the two words are used by most people as synonyms. And the word Boer has a more historical meaning, like the Boers of the Anglo-Boer War. The word Boer, of course, meaning farmer. The Afrikaners used to be very much an agricultural community, farmers initially in the Cape and then later up north. And so we became known as the Boers. But we also started calling ourselves the Afrikaners. And so some of the great Boer heroes who are generally referred to as Boers, people like General Christian de Wet, people like Joopy Fourie, who was this commander during the Afrikaner Rebellion, who was executed, they all called themselves Afrikaners. They called themselves Boers and Afrikaners. So in many ways, it's similar. But the debate here is that there's some section of the community. There's a section, I don't think it's very big, perhaps it's bigger than I think, that makes a distinction between the word Boer and Afrikaner, who would say that it's actually two nations. The Boers are the more conservative side, the more religious side, the sort of closer to the soil side, and the Afrikaners are the more modern, the more liberal side. You can make that argument because the word Afrikaner is a more modern word than the word Boer. The way I use the two is I use the word Boer more as an informal term. So I would say, oh, die Boere is kwaad, like the Boers are angry, or don't upset the Boers. Like when I'm talking tongue in cheek or sort of more humorously, I would call myself a Boer or a Boer. But when it's sort of more formal, I would say Afrikaner. But there's some debate. I think most people just see it as the same thing, with the word Afrikaner being sort of the more modern, more contemporary word, and Boer having a little bit more cultural and historical significance.
I did a podcast a while back about Sina van Rensburg, and the guest was saying to me that his understanding of Boer would be more ideological, more ideologically pure than, say, an Afrikaner, which is more of a national identity.
So one of the most famous traitors in Afrikaner history is Piet de Wet, the brother of Christian de Wet, the famous Boer War general and one of the greatest Afrikaner heroes ever. And so during the Anglo-Boer War, Christian de Wet became this hero, this leading figure, having all these incredible victories. And there were more than 100,000 British soldiers in South Africa trying to capture him. And he became this legendary figure. But then his brother, Piet, was fighting on behalf of the British. He was fighting for the British side. And so I've heard people say that that's the difference, that Christian de Wet is a Boer and Piet de Wet is an Afrikaner. But that doesn't quite fly, because Christian de Wet called himself an Afrikaner. But yes, I think there are people who view the word Boer as more sort of ideologically poor, more connected to our heritage. And in a way, I respect that. That doesn't really upset me when I hear people saying that, because I actually can see where that comes from. The Boers were the people, you know, who fought the Anglo-Boer War, who fought the British, who fought for the Boer republics. And so what you also hear people say sometimes is the Boers are the ones who want to restore the old republics, and the Afrikaners have sort of moved on. But I think it's an interesting debate, and I actually enjoy that debate. I enjoy those discussions, but I also think that we should not get too derailed by such discussions or debates or disagreements.
You said, though, that the Afrikaner, the word, is newer. How new? When was it used?
It's probably an older word than the word Boer, so maybe I should qualify that. I actually just published a piece on Substack about Hendrik Pibou, the so-called first Afrikaner. And so the short story, it's not a long story, but it's a fascinating story and a somewhat funny story, is it happened in 1707 in Stellenbosch, and there was a group of four boys about 16 years old who were running up and down the street making a noise. They had too much to drink and they were screaming, and one of these boys or young men was a man named Hendrik Pibou, and they were caught, and then the local magistrate came to punish them, and so he started beating them with a sambok, as we say, or a cane, and he said to them that he's going to deport them because they're disrupting the peace. And then Hendrik Pibou, this was sort of documented for the upcoming legal proceedings. He said, "You cannot deport me, you cannot send me away, because I am an Afrikaner. And even if you beat me to death, even if you try to send me away, I will not leave. This is my country and this is where I was born to be." It's along those lines. So what happened then is eventually the three others were trialed. He wasn't there at the trial. On the official documents, it just says gone or missing. And legend has it that this young man was sent to Batavia, which is Indonesia, Before that, the word Afrikaner was used, but it was referring to colored people in the Cape area. The Khoi Khoi and so forth were sometimes called the Afrikaners. But after that, the word Afrikaner became used to refer to people of Dutch and German and French ancestry living in South Africa. So it's actually an older word than the word Boer, but it didn't catch on as much as the word Boer did, like during the Anglo-Boer War. I'm not sure why, that there might be an important reason for that. But during the last century, the word Afrikaner became more popular among Afrikaners. So Boer is in a way newer and older than Afrikaner.
You mentioned a couple of times now the Dutch and the Netherlands, and there's obviously a strong backstory there. But I mean, Afrikaners today are not in any way Dutch. I mean, I was in Amsterdam last year, and it's entirely different language. You have to really concentrate to understand what they're saying. It's not super easy, but I mean, you can get by. And also, Afrikaners build straight up. They don't build skew buildings.
Well, we don't build on the canal as well, but in their defense. But so I have a friend in the Netherlands who tried to convince me that Afrikaans is just a dialect of Dutch.
Yes, me too.
Yeah. So you can, I mean, when you spend time in the Netherlands, you start catching on. You can sort of start following the language, but initially you can't understand anything. And then you sort of, your ear sort of gets attuned to that. But yes, Afrikaans had many influences. It's a Germanic language, just as Dutch is. But it's funny how we have words that they find very funny, and they have words that we find funny. I think melkskommel, for example, is, I think they just call it a milkshake. And so it's funny when they hear us talking about a melkskommel. And I know heisbak is sort of the popular word that the Dutch laugh about when they hear Afrikaners or Afrikaans people say heisbak for elevator, because heisbak means a bucket that goes up. And so they think it's very funny. And to me, it's strange to laugh at it because I'm just used to the word. That's what an elevator is in Afrikaans, is a heisbak. I know a lot of people wouldn't want to admit this, but I think if we are really frank and honest with ourselves, Afrikaners are culturally much closer to the British than to the Dutch. It's as a result of our history with the British. So over the last century or so, we were pretty much abandoned by the Dutch. Many of the Dutch didn't want anything to do with the Afrikaner people, which is a very sad story. But we became so intertwined by the British or with English people that, culturally speaking, we are much closer. And I actually heard someone say that just this week, someone who said to me that he recently spent time in Amsterdam and in London, and he felt more at home in London than in Amsterdam. And Amsterdam is a fantastic place, but I actually can understand why this person said this, because I think just we think and we act more like British people than like Dutch people. That's my observation, and I think there's truth in that.
What do you mean?
It's difficult to explain, to provide tangible examples. One way is food. I'm not a big fan of British food.
You just know in your heart.
Yeah.
You just know in your heart you're closer.
No, but we like English breakfast, you know, bacon and eggs and all of that. The way we set the table, you know, the English have all these mannerisms, these little cultural mannerisms, the way they, you know, the way they approach things like courtesy and so forth. The Dutch have a sort of, again, it's difficult to express tangibly, but the Dutch have, culturally speaking, have a different sort of way in which they engage socially. I think the way in which Afrikaners are as social beings is closer to the English. And some of my Dutch friends wouldn't like to hear me saying this, but to us, the Dutch are a little bit strange. The way they behave, the way they conduct themselves in conversations or social engagements, not because there's anything wrong with it, it's just different. They would, for example, be much more upfront. They would be much more in your face. They would confront you much easier. They're much less interested in small talk. It's difficult to pinpoint, but just spending time with an English person coming from England as opposed to a Dutch person coming from the Netherlands, I think most Afrikaners would resonate with the English person quicker than with the Dutch person.
Afrikanerdom is not very old. What is it, 250 years, 300 years old? The language itself is also thereabouts?
Yeah, the language is younger. Because, well, when was Arnoldus Spanifus? Was it before I can't remember what time. Was it before the Boer Wars? It must have been. Who sort of came here and who said, well, this language that these people are speaking is not Dutch anymore. It's something else. So yes, Afrikaans is, I think, 100 years old next year officially in terms of when it was accepted as an official language. Back then, even in the times of the Boer War, they spoke about the Dutch-speaking peoples. And even though the language has developed, you know, in its own way over hundreds of years, So yes, the Afrikaner community, well, you could say it's compared to, for example, the Hungarians, they would talk to you about, yeah, well, 900 years ago, we did this, and 1,500 years ago, our ancestors built that thing over there. And so it's very, very old. I mean, some of these European nations. And so by comparison, we're a very young, very new nation. Afrikaans was one of three languages to become a scientific language in the last century. But in a way, you could say it's not that old, because Jan van Riebeeck at least arrived in South Africa more than 100 years before the Declaration of Independence in America. So before America was a country, we were already in South Africa. So
yeah, yes. But he wasn't Afrikaans.
Yeah, but we weren't speaking Afrikaans. So it was Dutch people coming, and then French people and German people, and them eventually blending and developing a unique culture and a unique tradition and identity.
I say that, though, because the achievements by Afrikaners over the last, century have been incredible.
Yeah, well, someone said to me, actually, someone in the Netherlands said to me that the greatest achievement of the Afrikaner people was the creation of Biltong. And it's pretty, it's sad that, it's unfortunate that no one ever got a Nobel Prize for creating Biltong. And so,
that is a great thing to be known for.
Yes, and the people who created Biltong. And so even, yeah, like at my house, when we eat Biltong, my kids sometimes, when I explain to them that, you know, this is a very local thing, we eat Biltong, but people in other parts of the world don't have this, they were like completely shocked, and they were sad that sort of this is this amazing thing, but the rest of the world don't have it. And so it was actually quite funny to see the shock on my children's faces when they discovered that Biltong is a South African thing and people don't eat it in Europe and America. They have jerky, which is something along those lines, but it's not the same thing.
But I started this conversational off with talking about the great achievements of Afrikaners,
and we went to Biltong. Right, we went to Biltong immediately,
setting the bar very low.
Yeah, or high, depending on your frame of reference. But to get to your question, yes, there were many things. I mean, the first heart transplant was in Cape Town, Chris Barnard. There's actually a very strange or impressive list of inventions that was invented by Afrikaners, like the creepy crawly. I heard someone say the television, although I haven't been able to confirm that. Those big concrete slabs that they put in the ocean to block the waves is also a thing that I forgot the name of it now.
Night vision. Also, I think some form of night vision also that's used in the military.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Something like that. I can't remember.
But I mean, I actually saw a list of such things that came from the Afrikaners, although I don't have it with me. But I think other things that are not really inventions, one is our approach to warfare. Even today, people still study the tactics and of people like Koos de la Rey and Christian de Wet. This whole guerrilla war, the way they approached the Anglo-Boer War, the second phase of the Anglo-Boer War, was back then very unique, and the British didn't know how to deal with it. So that's one example. But I personally think the biggest achievement of the Afrikaner people is the extent to which we have developed our language and our literature over the last century. So to think about it, about 100 years ago, Afrikaans was not really recognized as an official language. There were a few people who started writing poetry in Afrikaans, like Eugene Marais and so forth. And then it just sort of exploded, and you got Celia Langenhoven and N.P. van Wyk Louw, and we have this massive treasure chest today of Afrikaans books, Afrikaans fiction, poetry, literature, all of that. So, and I think that was also an incredible achievement.
Something that you mentioned earlier, that Afrikaans is a Germanic language, but a lot of people don't know it was actually developed on the African continent.
Yes, and so Afrikaans also has words that aren't Germanic at all, especially Malay, influenced by Malay and so forth. So words like pisang is not a Germanic word. Babuti, baya, when we say baya. So baya means a lot. In German, you say vielen, like vielen Dank. So we have the word viel. Viel also means baya, but means a lot, but we usually say baya. And so we have all these words that susati, words like which is a kebab. We have all these words in our language that were sort of developed here. And also through modernization, we've developed our own way. And I do think it does seem to me that in the last century, the Afrikaners did more, or the Afrikaans community, to develop scientific words and unique words for our own language, and to then than I think the Dutch. And this is just my personal observation, because I find it strange sometimes going to the Netherlands and when I was there, and then I would ask, what's the Dutch word for this thing? And then they would just say the English word. They just use the English word. And I can only think of one word that is in English, but there's no Afrikaans translation, and I hope that we can keep it that way, and that's the word woke. There's not an Afrikaans word for woke, and hopefully we never develop one, but almost everything else there's an Afrikaans word for.
I've got one for you. Bluetooth. Why on earth would you want to say blowtunt?
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people say say blowtunt, but I remember when CDs came out, people immediately started saying, so what are we going to call it in Afrikaans? And a lot of people just said CD. I think that's what it's generally called in Afrikaans, is a CD. It's like just the Afrikaans pronunciation. And then some people said, no, it's a compact skive, so it must be a car S. It's like, put my car S in my car. And then others called it a laser plate, like a laser plate. And there was this big debate. And when SMSs came out, there were people saying that we cannot call it an SMS. SMS means short message system. So in Afrikaans, it's kort boodskap diens. So we must call it a kabiadia. And then I heard people saying, ek stuur vir jou 'n kabiadia. But that just didn't catch on. So I think a lot of people actually went into, every time we hear a new English word, we try to develop an Afrikaans word. And I think it's because Afrikaans was developed so recently, so that's sort of still in our frame of reference to develop the language.
You mentioned the Anglo-Boer War. I mean, what people also often don't realize, in my opinion at least, is that it's one of the greatest or most one of the most significant wars of the 20th century. 19th century also, I suppose, because it was at the beginning of the 20th. But it was phenomenally interesting because the British thought that they were going to finish off the Afrikaner, the Boers, in what, 2 months? And it took them 2 years. I mean, that is incredible stuff.
Yeah, it was a 3 years war. And initially, I think the war started in October. They said it's going to be over before Christmas. That was the popular saying back then. And then the joke among the Afrikaners was, but they didn't say which Christmas. But yes, I actually read a book earlier this year, I think, by Margaret Macmillan, called The War That Ended Peace. And so this book is about the First World War. And the questions she tries to answer is, the world has had enlightenment and all these great philosophies and freedom, and everyone's trading with each other. How could there suddenly be a world war that was as devastating as the Great War, as it was called initially? They didn't call it World War I when it broke out, because they didn't know that there would be a second. So they just called it the Great War. But what really struck me about her book was how often the Boer War was mentioned. Throughout the book, there's references to the Boer War as one of the major factors that led to the build-up to the First World War. And there are a few reasons for that. The one was, everyone feared the British because they had the strongest military in the world. Everyone sort of heard this thing that, oh, the British is now invading South Africa. It's going to be over before Christmas. And then 3 years later, they were still fighting. And so one way in which this sort of led to the First World War was people in, especially like in France and Germany and many of these other countries said, okay, well, maybe the British are not quite as strong as we thought they were. So that's one thing. And the other important thing is how European sentiment shifted in favor of the Boers. It has been described as the first media war in history, because it was fought at a time when newspapers were becoming very popular and very accessible. And so it was the first war really that people could follow in the newspaper every day. And so it really gripped people's imagination and people spoke about it, and they had opinions about this war, whether they were, especially in Europe, like in every European countries, but other places in America and so as well. And public sentiment was overwhelmingly in favor of the Boers. There are actually some video clips online of very, very old video clips of Paul Kruger visiting or arriving in Amsterdam to get support for the Boer cause. And there were 10,000 people waiting for him at the train station, just wanting to see Paul Kruger. And there's a photo of him in The Hague where he went to his hotel when he spoke there. And there was just this massive crowd of people standing outside his hotel, just wanting to see him. And then he came out on the balcony to sort of wave at the people, and then people took pictures. So there's a picture of him standing on the balcony at this hotel. And even in a place like Hungary, we recently discovered how the Hungarians were in favor of the Boers, how the Hungarian newspapers at the time wrote about the Anglo-Boer War. So it really was a massive event in world history. At the time, it was the most important thing happening in the world.
Just before that whole war happened, a group of I suppose, Boers left and went to Argentina. Do you know about them?
Yes, and there's still some descendants of them living in Argentina. And I've heard that there's still some people speaking who speak very broken Afrikaans. Although I've heard someone say recently that I think the last person who spoke Afrikaans there has passed away recently, or there's only one person left, or something like that. I actually don't know that story that well. I just know that there was a group of Afrikaners who went to Argentina. There was also a group, obviously, with a great track. Louis Trichardt went all the way up into what is today Zimbabwe or Mozambique. And so when my son saw that map of the great track, he saw Louis Trichardt went all the way up. And so his first reaction was, why did he go outside of South Africa? Like, he went over the border. But back then, there wasn't a border. So he went all the way up, and then he came back. He turned around and came back. There was also a group called the Dorsland Trekkers, which was a group who went on the western side up into Namibia, and they moved. They just carried on. They went up, I think, all the way into Angola. It's called the Dorsland Trek because they went through a desert. And so they had there's some really tragic stories about the Dorsland Trekkers and how they had to struggle to survive in the desert. But the Argentinian group is, I think, the farthest away that I'm aware of.
No conversation with you is complete without mentioning farm attacks in South Africa. It's a serious thing. I mean, it's a very serious thing, and the world doesn't really understand it. If you're an Afrikaner, just about every other Afrikaner that you know has a family member or a cousin or extended family member who's been affected by a farm attack.
That's why, part of the reason why I do what I do currently is I grew up in Zanin, in the Limpopo province, which is, you could say, an agricultural town. And I mean, I grew up with this reality, with people whom I knew who were attacked on farms. I can literally write down a list, and I have done that actually in my book, Kill the Boer, in the preface. I think it's like the first few pages of the book. Just to illustrate how serious this is, I mention all the people whom I know who have been attacked or whom I knew who were killed on farm attacks. And I remember, for example, an elderly lady in our church. I think she and her husband were killed on farm attacks in different occasions. And I remember there was a story when someone came in during a church service to run into the church to say that there was a farm attack, and this lady was murdered on the farm. And there was a boy who went to school with me who was murdered just after school. He just finished high school. Then he was murdered on a farm. He was just shot in the head while he was sleeping. And so I sort of grew up in this reality, having this fear also, because I lived on a farm also for a few years growing up, having this fear of, you know, when are they coming for me? And you lie in bed at night and you hear a branch falls from a tree and you think, oh, there's someone outside my window. I think a lot of people don't understand that. And also, to be a farmer is not supposed to be dangerous. It's supposed to be an exceptionally safe occupation, but not in South Africa. And so, yes, I think it's a very strange reality that we have to deal with in South Africa. And what really, really upsets me is the fact that there are so many people out there who are actively trying to prevent people from knowing about this problem, who are actively trying to discredit or discourage those who are trying to speak out, who are trying to raise awareness. And I don't know of anyone who has tried to argue that a farmer's life is more important than a taxi driver's life or something like that. What we're just saying is that this is a problem and this needs to be dealt with. But the moment when you say this, you get accused of conspiracy theories or racism or, you know, all these horrible things. It's bizarre. Why can we not just agree, listen, this is a problem and we need to do something about this? But I think there's an ideological reason why some people don't want to do this.
Well, without giving away locations, you know where my wife's family farm, small holding is. And, you know, we were just there last week and everybody is networked by two-way radio constantly. It's not safe. People don't grasp this. It's just simply not safe. And you have to constantly worry about your security, for example.
Yes, and you need to be armed. You need to be part, because you know that just relying on the police isn't going to help. So you need to be part of a farm watch or one of these AfriForum community safety networks. You need to have radios. In the old times, like when I grew up, there was this big radio the size of this old computer console that was in the hallway in the house or somewhere in the middle of the house. And then you could hear people talking on the radio all the time. That's how I grew up. And then you could any moment you could just pick up the radio and talk, and then like everyone would hear you. And I remember it was this very strict thing that no one is allowed to speak on the radio because, you know, as children, we just wanted to make jokes on the radio because we hear people talking and then we wanted to make funny noises. I don't know if the farms have that anymore because people have these radios that they just carry with them and they have all these apps and things and drones. And so I think a lot of farmers have become very advanced in the ways in which they protect themselves. But you have to do that. You cannot afford not to do that. If you don't do that, then you run the risk of losing your life or losing someone in your family. So it's not a luxury that you can take.
A lot of the international audience might not know, but the majority of South African farmers are white Afrikaners.
Yes, I think so. It's a bit difficult to calculate numbers like that. I know there have been some attempts to do that, but the problem is many farms are owned by companies. And so, you know, companies are often owned or controlled by people from different race groups. And there's not really census data in which they actually ask the race of the farmer, but there has been some attempts to do that. And so that's the argument, is that farms are disproportionately white in South Africa. Farmers are disproportionately white. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people, especially on the left of the political spectrum, don't want to recognize this problem, because doing that implies that they have to recognize that white people are victims and that they're...
Yeah, the attackers are black.
Yeah, well, the attackers are 100% black. I actually only know, I mean, there's been thousands upon thousands of farm attacks. And I mean, I've studied this for years to the extent that I've written a book about this. I'm only aware of one case where one of the attackers was an Indian person. But other than that, the attackers are 100% black. And the victims are not 100% white. They are black victims as well, but the victims are disproportionately white. And also the tortures are almost exclusively inflicted on white people. So the type of most grotesque tortures you can imagine happening during farm attacks. When you hear about a farm attack and you hear there was a torture, it's almost guaranteed that it was a white farmer. Other than that, also the political slogans chanted during these attacks. You know, people chanting things like, you know, Viva Malema is one, or Die White Man, apartheid is over. But the worst cases I know of is when the attackers actually took the blood of the victims and wrote messages on the walls with blood. And in one case, they even wrote "Kill the Boer" with the blood of the Boer. It was actually not a Boer. It was a woman. It was an elderly mother and daughter who were murdered, very, very grotesquely tortured. And they used their blood to write "Kill the Boer" on the wall, which is a reference to the prison gang, I can only assume. And then we have people trying to say either no, it doesn't exist, or you're a racist for raising alarm about this, or it's not that bad, you know, or why aren't you complaining about people being killed in townships? And why can't we just recognize that this is a problem and do something about this? It's really, really bizarre.
Just this week, two women were murdered.
Yes, I saw that in the news, yes. One of the problems with this is it's almost impossible, if not, to really say how many victims there are. It's almost like rape or sexual offenses. We know that the actual number is much higher than what is reported because a lot of the victims don't go to the police for whatever reason, psychological reasons, or they don't want it to be known, or they're just trying to sort of cut this out from their memory. And so we do know when we hear crime statistics about rape or sexual assault, especially sexual assault, we know for a fact the actual number is much higher than that. But you can say the same about farm attacks. Now, I think a farm murder, the statistics that you get is fairly accurate because it's very unlikely that someone would be murdered on a farm and the police or the media wouldn't know about this. But a farm attack, I mean, I've spoken with people who've said to me, I was attacked on my farm and I didn't report it to the police. And I said, why? And they said, well, it won't change anything. So firstly, a lot of people just don't report this to the police. And even if they do, the police often don't count it as farm attacks because there's this big issue with the police and the police statistics that they just say assault or something. It's not counted on their system as a farm attack. So we don't know how many attacks there are really, but from the police statistics that was published over a few decades, I did this when I wrote the book, is I took as many years and as many figures as I could to spread them out over as long a time frame as I could. And I took two decades of farm attacks according to police data. And just to calculate how many farm attacks are there per day or per week. And the answer was there was an average two per day, two farm attacks every day in South Africa. And we know the actual number is higher than that. It's extremely alarming. And now again, go back to the fact that it's not supposed to be a problem at all. To be a farmer is not supposed to be dangerous in terms of your chances of being attacked and killed in your house. But in South Africa, it is.
Do you think that the majority of these attacks are by design or by emergence? In other words, are they planned or random?
Yeah, I cannot say what the case would be for the majority. There's been some attempts to study the motives behind these attacks. What we can say is that some of the studies that have been done have found that stuff like labor-related issues or mistreatment of workers is about 1%. It's very, very unlikely for these attacks to happen because of the farmers abusing their workers. But you hear people say that. You hear politicians and journalists say, well, if the farmers just stop abusing their workers, then the workers will stop killing them, as if that's an excuse. But that's a very, very marginal phenomenon. I think you can say some of these attacks happen because of, you could say, robbery gone wrong. Like someone goes to steal a TV and then he gets confronted and there's a scuffle or a fight and then someone dies. I'd say that I'm convinced that that happens. But it's also undoubtedly the case that many of these attacks, or at least some of these attacks, are politically motivated. And the reason why we know this is because the attackers say so. The others say so through slogans, as I mentioned, during the attack, or they say so during the court proceedings. They would say, well, I did this because I'm a member of this political party. This one guy who committed 5 farm murders, and then he said, my hatred for white people made me do it. And then he said in court, for me, killing white people is like going to work. And I mean, we've had people even testify that they committed these attacks as a result of their political allegiances or political views. What the percentage is, we don't know. I think the way to calculate that, it's possible, but what we would need is a proper comprehensive study with preferably a psychologist and a criminologist, going to these prisons, interviewing people who have been convicted of committing these murders and interviewing a big enough sample, 200, I don't know, and asking them the right questions to make sure having the right methodology. I think that would be very useful. But now the issue here is firstly access to these people, because you have to work through the government. And secondly, I am aware of some people who have attempted such studies, but who are very ideologically, you know, they have this approach of, I'm going to do this study to prove that it's not politically motivated. You shouldn't go in trying to prove something. You should go in trying to find out what's the truth. We don't have a proper study like that.
So where to from here for Afrikaners? What's the future?
I think the most important thing that we're doing and that we need to keep doing is building institutions. One of the biggest mistakes that we've made, or the biggest mistake in the past century, was to become very dependent on the state. And we weren't that, actually. After the Anglo-Boer War, the Afrikaners built institutions. They had this Help Mekaar movement to build universities, build schools as a community, have fundraisers, build institutions. And then in the second half of the last century, we became very statist. We somehow reached the conclusion that the best way forward is to have a very strong state and to make sure that all societal problems are dealt with by the state. And so we developed this massive state, the apartheid state, during the previous century, which turned out to be a massive failure. And so I think there's a lot we can say about that part of history, but I think we can at least agree that this was a strategic, a very serious mistake. And so I think we're correcting that now. And there's some value in having a good functioning state, but we are forced through our circumstances not to rely on the state, because we know it's not going to make a difference. If we just go and, I mean, voting is good and it's fine if you vote in elections, but that's not going to solve our problems. We're just too small of a minority in this very big territory that is called South Africa. And so the way forward is to build our own institutions. If we're concerned about what our children are being taught in schools, we have to build our own schools. If we're concerned about the media, we have to build our own media institutions. If we are concerned about our rights being violated, we have to build AfriForum and groups like that. And that's what the solidarity movement is about. And I think I'm sure we will learn a lot of lessons along the way, but I think we have learned enough so far to realize that it's a good way to spend your time and energy, is to build strong community institutions.
It's a long game.
Yes, it is a long game. So we have this saying that, unlike politicians, we're not working for the next election, we're working for the next generation. And so the work that we're involved with is not aimed at creating some form of a solution within 5 years from now or something to that effect. The work that we're involved with is aimed at ensuring a better future for our children. And again, in our Western tradition, we have almost extreme examples of this, of people building a cathedral and then keep carrying on with that project for 800 years. So your great-great-grandchildren aren't even going to see the end result, but you do it in any case. So there's some important lessons that we can learn from Western history and the old Christian tradition. And I think that this idea of recognizing that there are things out there that are bigger than yourself, and that we have a responsibility to contribute to this. I think philosophically, that's what the whole movement is based on. And practically, what the movement is doing is building institutions.
You mentioned Afrikaners were quite strategically bad over the last 50 years or so. I would say that one of those reasons is because Afrikaners tend to be very honest. Calling something apartheid is a very bad strategy, for example.
Yes, well, I think that's true. And Afrikaners are very honest, very stubborn, but also in a way naive. And so we can even go back to history longer back than that was during the Great Trek. The strategy was basically, you know, buy land from the Zulus and move into the heart of the biggest military force in Africa and then build a future for ourselves right there in Zululand. And
what could go wrong? Yeah,
exactly. And also with the Anglo-Boer War, there's this famous story of General Pitjuber. He was the hero of the first Anglo-Boer War, actually, where he defeated the British at the Battle of Majuba, bringing an end to the war. He was then much older during the second Anglo-Boer War. So there's also this history, this lesson of older generations sort of losing touch with realities and not being as efficient as they were. But with him, during the second war, he became a source of annoyance for the younger generals because they, for example, beat the British at Ladysmith, and then the British were on the run. And then he said, when God gives you the pinky, you shouldn't grab the hand. And so we just leave them to run away. And the younger general said, well, we should go and attack, and we should go all the way to Durban and take the harbor so that they can't bring more people on the ships. And he was just not interested in doing that. He didn't think strategically. So we've had a few strategic blunders in the past. And about the apartheid system, Tony Leon actually summarized that pretty well when I interviewed him for that documentary we made, Tainted Heroes. He said, in the last century, there were many states all over the world who had racialized legislation. The idea of having laws that, or a system in which people are, you know, treated differently or categorized according to race was pretty much the standard about a century ago. But no one had gone through the effort of codifying that and making sure every detail is written in law, published as a law, as the Afrikaners did. It was also very naive. Not just naive, I think it was wrong to try to do this. I think the idea of separate, or the idea of self-determination is inherently a good idea. But the way it was implemented was just disastrous. And then this naive thing of just saying, oh, well, we're just going to put everything in writing so that everyone can see exactly. It failed spectacularly. And it became, and again, Tony Leon's words were, the Afrikaners became a moral target, but not only a moral target, also became an easy target as a result of the apartheid system. And I think it was obviously a massive failure. And I think it started with this idea that we need to use the government to solve our problems. And that's where you end up with when you become too statist and you lose your sense of community and of morality in an important sense of the word.
Ernst, how can I follow your work?
Okay, so I'm actually, as you mentioned in your introduction, I am with the Solidarity Movement, but we just started a new foundation called the Afrikaner Foundation, which is aimed at encouraging international cooperation. So I think this is actually quite relevant for your listeners to follow. They can follow me on social media, but also the Afrikaner Foundation. You can make a contribution, like a monthly contribution through the website. But we're on social media. We're on X and, you know, Facebook and YouTube. We have a podcast called the Pioneer Podcast. You can look it up on social media platforms. It's published in video form on YouTube and also on Substack. I very recently started on Substack. So I'm still new on Substack, but it's a fascinating platform. I was actually surprised to see how big you are on Substack and how often you post there. And Substack, I'm in South Africa, Substack isn't very big, but to our friends abroad, they would know that Substack is very important. So I think people can go and follow me on Substack as well.
But more importantly, where can people buy Biltong?
Well, you have to come to South Africa. There are actually places where you can buy it and have it shipped to your home. And I think you can actually have it sent to you internationally. If you're in England, I think in London, there's some places. You find some places like Afrikaans shops that sell biltong. I don't know. Yeah, it's important. Support your local biltong dealer, even though biltong in England is not quite the same as biltong in the Bosveld in South Africa.
I'm going to go have some biltong now. I bought some biltong from a butcher called De Vleesvinkel. Yeah. So you know you're on the right path. Yeah.
Exactly. We couldn't settle for the word butcher or butchery, so we had to make an Afrikaans word. And then we just call it De Vleesvinkel, yeah.
Aaron Roots.
Thank you very much. It was great to be on the show, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, my friend.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.